I'm Brian Rood, and this is the second session this week. I'll be leading on El Salvador. And the theme this morning is passion for justice. And we'll be looking especially at the issue of justice around land, access to land, which is really, I feel, at the root of the exploitation, the inequalities in El Salvador, and which has led to a lot of the violence around the civil war and so on. Before I go any further, and before I forget, as I did yesterday, I'll recommend two books which are available in the bookstore, both just recently published, actually this year. The one is a book written by Mirardo Gomez, the bishop, Lutheran bishop of El Salvador, written first, of course, in Spanish, Fuego contra Fuego, but now available in English, Fire Against Fire. The translation is by Mary Solberg, and with a couple chapters added by Bill Dexheimer, who is an ELCA missionary in El Salvador. So it's short, but very full of content. $5.95. My one regret about this English translation is that it does not include a wonderful introduction written by a Salvadoran poet. So if you do read Spanish and have a way of getting the Spanish edition, check it out, because it is a powerful introduction to Mirardo Gomez by a poet who knows Mirardo very well. But of course, this one then includes the follow-up, Mirardo Gomez and the Church's Struggle, written by Bill Dexheimer, and then a chronology of events in El Salvador, also by Bill Dexheimer. And there's some helpful information in the back, map and statistics, as well as suggested resources, newsletters, reports, videos, books, all of which are very helpful. So this has just been published in English within the last few months. And also another one which has just come out in the last few months is El Salvador, A Spring Whose Waters Never Run Dry. Scott Wright is the editor. Most of the stories are taken from Carta a las Iglesias, a publication, Letter to the Churches, put out by the UCA, the Central American University, the Jesuit University in San Salvador. And so they collect stories of people throughout the country. And that Letter to the Churches is available in English also, but this is a compilation of some of the more powerful of those, as selected by Scott Wright. And it's set up in the format with a brief historical introduction, giving a bit of context to the situation in which the account is written. Then it includes the story, and then followed is completed with a scriptural quotation. So to begin this session, we'll use a story set to slides and with some background music about a Salvadoran peasant. Me llamo José. Yo y mi familia somos campesinos. Pero ya no vivimos en el campo, sino en la ciudad, en esta ciudad sucia de San Salvador, en una champita de cartón. No nos gusta vivir aquí, pero ya que ya no hay alternativa, aquí estamos. My name is José. I and my family are farmers, peasant farmers. But we no longer live on our farm in the country, but rather in the city, in this dirty city of San Salvador. We live in a tiny shack, a shack made of cardboard. We don't like living here, but since we no longer have any alternative, here we are. We are a long way from home now, and it makes me sad and angry to think back on how we got from there to here. I grew up on my parents' farm, which was also my grandparents' farm and my great-grandparents' farm before them. Our roots were as deep as those of the oak forests which once surrounded us. I had always thought I would spend my entire life farming that land with my family, and then someday pass it on to my children, who in turn would pass it on to their children. There in that rich corner of God's creation, which God had given us to care for, God was good to us. The rains came every year. Always they started in May, and there was always plenty of rain through the 6 months of the rainy season to ensure that our crops of corn would produce enough to feed us all throughout the year until the next harvest. That corn was our daily bread. After the harvest, we would dry it, rub it off the husks, grind it, mix it with water into a paste, and form the round tortillas, which we would bake over our wood-fire stove. That corn was our daily bread. Corn has become a life symbol for us, for everyone in our whole Latin American family. We had 15 acres of rich land with rich volcanic soil in a rich valley. We had enough land so that we could let some land rest each year to restore its fertility. And each year in April, we would yoke our team of oxen and head out to the milpa, the cornfield, to begin the plowing. And just as the rains were about to begin, we would plant those precious seeds, grains of corn from the previous year's harvest, with a prayer that God would once again bless us with an abundant harvest, so that we might feed our family for yet another year. It was a simple life and a good life. We shared it with many wonderful neighbors, many of them blood relatives, extended family. But even those not related were still part of our family. All of these, too, had farmed their lands for many generations. We were always there to help one another. About 20 years ago, we got a notice from the government saying that we would now have to pay taxes for this land we were using, 600 colones each year. Of course, since we had little extra to sell, we had little money to pay taxes. We couldn't pay, so we didn't pay. 2 years after that, some men came from the government to survey the land. None of them talked to us or to any of our neighbors. A couple of them were white, but most were Salvadoran. They obviously didn't consider themselves to be part of our family, or us to be part of theirs. After surveying, they began building fences around our plots of corn. Then we were delivered a notice saying that since we had not paid our taxes and had never had title to this land, we would have to move off the land. Some people from San Salvador had bought the land. That seemed very strange to us. How could anyone buy land when it all belonged to God, who had given it to everyone to use, so that we all could work the land and live and give life to our families? Anyway, these new owners would be using the land to grow coffee. The notice mentioned the possibility that we might have an opportunity to work on the coffee plantation, if we were fortunate. Since we had no place to go, we stayed. We kept farming our fields of corn. Soon 12 soldiers from the army came, armed with big guns, to kick us off our land, forcibly if necessary. With very sad hearts, we gathered a few of our belongings from the house, joined our neighbors, and made our way up the slopes of the mountains, seeking a new place to settle and call home. Of course, the hillsides were all heavily forested, so we had to work hard to clear enough land to be able to plant crops. The chopped trees we could use for firewood for our cooking fires. But we always seemed to use up the wood too quickly. But what other option did we have? So we planted our corn on the steep hillsides. But it was not easy to plant. It was not easy to tend. It was not easy to harvest. On one slope, we had to tie ourselves to a stake so we didn't slide down the steep hill. And when the heavy rains came, they washed the soil down the hills so quickly. So quickly, the rich soil grew thinner. How long could it last? And in the dry season, which became longer and longer each year, the strong winds blew away the soil. Soil that no longer had any firm tree roots to keep it in place. So quickly the soil disappeared. So quickly, the terrain became rockier. After a few years, the land could hardly grow corn anymore. We couldn't find enough suitable land to be able to allow some land to rest or lie fallow, to restore its fertility. Soon we had to give up on corn. Corn, which our people, all people of Latin America, have used for centuries to make our tortillas, our daily bread, our symbol of life. We had to switch to sorghum, animal feed, which grows in poorer, thinner soil. So we learned to make tortillas out of sorghum. And we cried over such a sad substitute, such tasteless tortillas. In another couple years, the soil would no longer produce sufficient sorghum either. So our children were getting sick more and more frequently. They simply weren't getting enough to eat. And the many animals, the monkeys, the jaguars, and the birds that used to share our world, had all moved away, had died, had become extinct. Then I did something I thought I would never do. I went back to our former land and I found the manager of the coffee plantation and asked if there was any work for me. There wasn't. But I was forced to go back over and over again. In desperation. How demeaning. I never imagined I'd have to beg for anything, especially work. Finally, there was an open space, and I became a day laborer on the coffee plantation. I traveled back and forth each day, but eventually our whole family moved into one of the shacks at the edge of the coffee plantation. Soon our whole family, even the children, became workers. Since I was paid so poorly that I couldn't make enough money to buy food for the whole family. The work was hard, backbreaking, hot under the burning sun for such long hours. And the planes would fly overhead spraying the crops and us and the shack where we lived with pesticide, DDT. Once a group of farmers from North America came to visit. And they were shocked to see us using DDT, and especially when we didn't have any protective clothing, nothing. They said DDT had been prohibited in North America for years. How did it get here? And why would they spray so heavily? So it was getting in the irrigation canal, our only source of water. The irrigation canal where we washed clothes, where we got our drinking water, where most of the garbage and sewage from the plantation got dumped. After one heavy spraying, the wind swept much of the DDT over our shack. Within 2 days, our one-year-old child got very ill. She died a week later. The DDT spray also got blown over onto the cattle grazing pasture. We don't ever eat that beef, it's all sold to North America. Another visitor told me that one shipment was refused by inspectors. Because the beef had 19 times as much DDT chemical in it as was acceptable in North America. Finally, when another child became very ill from the DDT, we decided we'd have to stop working on the coffee plantation and move once again. We couldn't go back to the mountain. Any land we had cleared and farmed would be used by someone else already. We didn't have much choice. So we snuck off in the night and began our long trek to San Salvador. I had only been there once, and it was hard to think about leaving the countryside, moving our family into the city. I remembered it being very dirty and noisy and crowded and smelly. The sun didn't shine as brightly there. How could we live there? But I was sure we'd be able to find some kind of work there. It would have to be easier to make a living, easier to feed my family. Once there, we found our way to a little shanty town in the ravine. And people there said there was a little corner of space on the edge, up on the hillside, where we could put up a shack, if we could find some cardboard and sticks to build it. Over the next week, we did scrounge enough scraps of garbage to put up a shelter, even a holy sheet of plastic to throw over top for some protection from the rain. My wife and I went to the congested street markets, looking around for odd jobs to get a little money for food. One day I bumped into an old neighbor from our little farm up on the steep hillside. They had stayed for a while, but once the Civil War started in the early 80s, the Air Force jets flew over a lot, and the Army came through looking for FMLN guerrillas, they said. They burned our crops, destroyed our granaries, so we wouldn't feed the guerrillas, they said. My once proud neighbor almost cried, telling me this. They burned the little patches of forest that remained, so the FMLN guerrillas couldn't hide, they said. So now the mountains hardly have any trees left. Finally, the Air Force bombed our village, so we wouldn't be able to shelter the guerrillas, they said. He continued with their story. As we fled, the Army soldiers shot many of our villagers with their M16s. Automatic rifles sent from the U.S., so determined to keep these greedy people in control. People who just didn't understand family, who just didn't understand about caring for God's good earth. We tried to save all we could. Some corpses we just had to leave behind. When we hid in culverts or caves or underground pits to protect ourselves, they dropped bombs of white phosphorus and napalm around us, chemicals that burnt us badly, especially our children's eyes. Some of our men and children were tortured and shot along the flight. Many of our women and girls were raped. Once we got to San Salvador, we were sheltered in the courtyard of a church, where we stayed for 1 year before we decided to build our own shack in one of the ravines of the city. But here, none of us have any water. We have to search for an open tap where we can steal water. And there are no latrines. The sewage just has to run down our ditches. So we are sick most of the time. We usually don't have energy to work, even if we could find work. And here too, most of the trees are gone because they've been used as firewood for our cooking fires. So here the heavy rains cause landslides, washing our shacks right down the steep hillsides. When that happens at night, sometimes the neighbor's children have been injured, even killed. So it continues. In order for a few to stay wealthy and get even wealthier, they have to kill everything around them. They kill the trees, they kill the crops, they kill the water. They kill the farmers, they kill the children, they kill the air. Their industries kill us, their development kills us, their plantations kill us, their army kills us. Now our own water and air kill us. How do we survive? Where do we go to find life when we're surrounded by death on all sides? How can our families survive all the vicious, or all the violence and hunger and sickness? Will we all die before we find life? How can God's good creation survive this onslaught, this destruction? Will we all die before we find life?
Thank you.
other side of the situation in Latin America and many places in the world where access to land becomes a justice issue, the magnitude of life and death, a survival issue. We have in our part of the world, ourselves as consumers, and in many cases, complacent consumers. When I came back from El Salvador to Canada, I encountered a Canada that was significantly different in one respect. I've been gone only just over a year, yet when I had gone to El Salvador, I remember environmental concerns in Canada being something still kind of on the fringe. It was the radicals, the fringe element of society that was concerned about environmental issues. And when I came back, recycling was the craze. Everybody had figured out that for our own survival, it was important to figure out something smarter to do with our mounds of garbage. And so even politicians now, in order to be elected, had to be environmental fanatics and had to be promoting recycling. In the midst of all of this, I was in many homes. In fact, in Calgary, I was invited to a couple of receptions in the homes of friends, homes which are really castles. The real estate market in Calgary is quite a bit less expensive than in cities like Toronto and Vancouver, and I presume most US cities. And so you can get quite a huge place for a relatively moderate sum. But coming back from El Salvador and some of the shacks that we saw in the slides, it was quite a jump to come into these monstrosities. I remember one evening being in the home of a friend of mine with her two young children, and she'd invited many friends, many of them Salvadoran friends, for this reception. And there were about 60 of us in the home, and it hardly seemed to fill the home. And she, among, as with all Canadians, was very concerned about doing the right things with their garbage. I asked, when we left the place, I asked the Salvadoran friends who share my home what they thought of the place, and the response was that, well, a lot of people could eat for the price of that home. And also they said that if any of us were ever fortunate to have a place that size, we would certainly share it with several families. And so my question about our society following that was, well, we figured out that we have to do something smarter with our garbage, but why do we produce so much garbage in the first place? And it seemed to have a lot to do with consumerism. Last night's forum touched on a lot of those issues, and I presume the session next door is talking about a lot of this too. But the song Complacent Consumers was kind of a response to, I think, one of the serious questions that we need to address to ourselves about justice in places like El Salvador.
Blue. House is supporting this craziness.
Well, Canada is in a very fortunate position. I mean, we can benefit from the kind of lifestyle that the U.S. is struggling to preserve without looking like the culprits.
Right.
So, I mean, so we can sort of quietly, tacitly sit by and allow that to go on without looking like we're the ones doing it or being involved with it. Over the last, I guess, 15 years or so, our government has really, especially with this present government, Brian Mulroney and the Conservative government again, have been much quieter about resisting U.S. policy or speaking out against it. And I think that has a lot to do with wanting free trade. I mean, they're promoting free trade between the U.S. and Canada, and they don't want to jeopardize those economic arrangements.
Yeah.
And so they're very quiet about U.S. foreign policy or U.S. immigration, refugee policy. And in fact, we succumb on those levels to pressures from the U.S. to change our own policies. Among the population, I think there's a significant sentiment or understanding that Canada should be more of a voice speaking out against those kinds of policies. And some of that's within the churches. I think more of it is among solidarity groups, among the general population. And that's what I've been working to promote, and many others are working to promote, you know, within the churches and student groups and workers across society. Now, Beth, you might have a reflection on that too about where we're at.
I think you pretty well covered it. I think, you know, there has been some really strong pressure groups in Canada. There's been a real struggle between a lot of the non-governmental organizations and, you know, solidarity groups and the government. And at one point there came a key question when the Canadian Hunger Foundation wanted to send bilateral aid to the government in order to provide food to the poor. And it was roundly condemned by all the non-governmental organizations. At that point, the Canadian Hunger Foundation then said, well, we're going to go ahead anyways, and they have been totally ostracized from the whole non-governmental organization and solidarity group organization. So, I mean, they're really strong feelings, and, you know, it's these groups that have very active advocacy among the government people. So there's a lot of work going on, and I think that a lot of them, individuals in external affairs and so on, are very aware and have strong feelings themselves, but again, feel that their hands are tied to a certain extent to how much, you know, given our economic ties with the state and so on, how much, you know, we can say without jeopardizing a lot of things, but there's lots of pressure.
It was revealing, well, actually about a week after I came home last November, I got a call from Ottawa and an invitation from Joe Clark, who's the Minister for External Affairs, wanting to meet with both Karen Ridd, the woman from Winnipeg, had been working with Peace Brigades International and had been expelled from El Salvador just a few days after I had been. And so he wanted to meet with both of us, and the whole External Affairs Department was there also. And so we spent a couple of hours. He wanted to hear our story, our reflections, our perceptions of the situation, and also wanted to inform us about what he and the government were doing with respect to El Salvador, some of which was public policy, and some of it was kind of bilateral or multilateral arrangements with other countries in Europe or Latin America, which was kind of behind-the-scenes work. And it was revealing to discover how informed or fairly well informed he was about the situation, and his understanding was that, at least as he expressed it to us, was that the U.S. involvement in El Salvador was paranoiac and inappropriate, unsuitable. And yet he could never say that publicly or put any policy around that. So on the one hand, he had, you know, fairly an understanding which kind of matched what we were confirming. But on the other hand, he had to be very quiet and careful about what he would state publicly or what Canadian diplomats could say in Washington or what they could formulate in terms of public policy, government policy. And he named a number of reasons why that was so. Part of it economic. We don't have the funds to be able to set up embassies in various countries in Latin America to be more of a presence there. We don't have funds to do much kind of lobbying in Washington. The policy at that time, and I believe this still stands, is that they understand the five Central American countries, or five Central American countries, to be equal. So they want to maintain equal diplomatic relations with each of the five countries. So they can't give more aid to one of the countries or withdraw from one of the countries without jeopardizing their relations with the other four. Which at that point seemed absurd. I mean, the Sandinistas were still governing Nicaragua, and the situation in each of the countries is so different. How could we assume that we should need to maintain equal and equivalent relations with all of those countries? But that was the official policy. And so, particularly with respect to El Salvador, the aid was, 8 to 12 million through Canadian Hunger Foundation. That was the agency chosen to administer Canadian funds in El Salvador. And it was a program subject to U.S. or Salvadoran government approval. And any of the projects approved could be vetoed by the Salvadoran government. I'm not sure if that ever happened. The Canadian ambassador to Central America at one point told me that there had been a project vetoed. Others couldn't confirm that. I'm not sure. And it's a very complex program. Canada sells, Saskatchewan is a country, is a province that produces an excess of potash, which is fertilizer. You used to make fertilizer, and so apparently we have a lot of extra BS to
ship. To a barrel that's right in view of the government buildings, and you ask people what aid have they received, and if the Canadian government is giving some, and we're giving $1.5 million a day, and all this. And those people had not seen, and it was earthquake victims. So, you know, that's the sort of thing you think is going to get some international aid. And the only international aid they had seen was tents to house them right after their housings were uninhabitable, you know, the houses. Mm-hmm. And then it was Lutheran church assistance for after that. So here they were in view of the government buildings, and they had received no direct aid from the government. So you wonder where it goes. And I know, you know, in the New York Times it was that Duarte's nephew had been charged of graft, $2 million worth of graft. And so, you know, some of it's going there. But some of it has to be going to some people. And with that amount of money there, and you know a lot of it goes to military hardware. But it's just kind of amazing that it wouldn't show up in somewhere.
Yeah, a significant percentage of that, and I don't remember the exact figure, but it is directly for military aid. But a huge amount of the economic aid also gets channeled to really military purposes. And it's used in the counterinsurgency efforts, which is a fairly sophisticated way of fighting the war without it looking like war. Winning the hearts and minds of the people, and you know, having these programs in various communities, government-sponsored communities, to try and convince the people that the government and its army are benevolent and wanting to benefit the people. It's not an easy job after all the people have suffered at the hands of the army, but huge amounts of aid go to that, and also, I mean, the graft and corruption is extreme. Members of the military are dependent on the war and USAID to maintain lifestyles that rival and surpass the lifestyles of the business class in many cases. Especially, I mean, members of the Tandona, the big military class of 66 that control most of the army, and they're there to defend one another and from prosecution in human rights cases or prosecution in terms of graft and corruption. So they become very, very comfortable with all of this.
The military seems to be a power unto itself. The president isn't under control, and they seem to be their own bosses. What do you think, if anything, can be done to take away their power or begin to alleviate, because at least as far as the American press is concerned, especially with the killing of the priests, in which obviously it was the military who did that, and they were let off scot-free, and obviously it was a setup, that it's almost as if the government's hands are tied when it comes to controlling such abuses. What do you think can be done to move things in the other direction?
Yeah. Well, that is the focal point and the stumbling block for the current negotiations. I mean, what happens with the military? How do you purge the military of the corrupt elements? And how do you reduce the military, demobilize a large block of the military? And a major concern is bringing the three security forces under civilian control also, which the National Police, the Treasury Police, and the National Guard, making them into a civilian controlled force. And there are strong right-wing elements that just will resist any kind of concessions on that score. Although Kristani seems at points in the negotiations to be willing to address those issues, but as you say, doesn't have the power to do that. I think what it will take is, for one thing, a significant cut in aid from the U.S., because that's what keeps them going, what keeps them thriving. And also in isolation internationally, that the international community will not tolerate that military persisting with its control, of human rights violations, the corruption, maintaining the war at that moment. And there's possibilities of that with the UN not negotiating this current, or mediating this current series of negotiations, but those keep breaking down as they did again last week. I think that's what's necessary, but I don't know how realistic that is. But there are indications that the military aid, or that those determining policies out of Washington are changing their views and perhaps moving more and more toward cuts in military aid. And that'll take a lot of pressure from not only, U.S. citizens, but I think also other countries. Like, that's what we're trying to encourage of Canadians also. That our government put pressure on Washington to cut military spending and military aid. Well, that's our time for today. So if you have questions or want to chat in between sessions, please welcome your comments and your stories also at any time. So thanks for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.